Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is HTTP Session Management Options in WebSphere Application Server for CLS version 7. Today's presenter is Chad Mothelwell. Chad has worked as a Level 2 support technician with WebSphere on the CLS platform for 8 years. He currently serves as the technical lead for their support team. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Chad.
Okay, thanks, Joseph. You can go ahead and move to slide 2, please. Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you all for attending. Today's presentation is going to center on gaining a better understanding of the core HTTP session management options in WebSphere version 7 on ZOS. So we're going to start with a quick overview of HTTP sessions and make sure everyone has a good grasp of the fundamentals of HTTP sessions. And then we'll talk about the default configuration, which we generally refer to as in-memory session management. And we'll move on to talk about database persistence. And finally, we'll finish up with a discussion of probably the least understood option, which is memory-to-memory session replication. Throughout these last three discussion points, I'll compare the configurations with each other to highlight the upside and downside to each one of them, which is important so you can make a good educated decision about which configuration is appropriate for the environment that you're going to be servicing web apps in. So I'll also be giving some high-level overviews and pointing out the documentation about how to configure each of the options, and we'll talk a little bit about when you may want to consider using each one. Okay, slide 3, please. So again, we'll start off with a very quick general overview of HTTP sessions, and I felt that some basic information about how sessions work was necessary to really understand all the configuration options. So this is going to be a very basic overview, and just to make sure that we don't leave anyone behind when we get to the core of the presentation. Slide 4, please. So as you've probably heard at one time or another, HTTP is a stateless protocol, and this means that it has no built-in means of maintaining state information from request to request. And so this is really where HTTP sessions grew out of. They grew out of this need to maintain user information for use on subsequent requests. The classic example is a shopping cart for an online store. So the cart holds stuff you're planning to buy later, but meanwhile you're allowed to continue shopping without losing track of those items. So the shopping cart is a means of maintaining your state information from request to request, and usually this is going to be accomplished through HTTP sessions. Slide 5, please. So that's what HTTP sessions are. Let's get a little more in-depth and talk about how they actually work. The HTTP sessions that we're focusing on are server-side sessions, and there are such things as client-side sessions, but those aren't configurable through WebSphere, so they really fall outside the scope of this presentation. At the high level, an HTTP session is just an object stored on a server capable of holding information about a client. And we associate that object with a client via a unique ID. Since we're talking about J2E environments, here, that object will be a Java object usually, and the association is done via a cookie stored on the browser side. And we'll talk a little more about the cookie in a minute, but let's just run through a session lifetime starting from the beginning. The session object is created on the server when a servlet or JSP calls the getSession method, which is part of the servlet API. This creates an instance of an HTTP session object, which will be assigned that unique ID I referred to earlier within the server. Slide 6, please. Okay, so we're on slide 6, and just continuing on. Once the session object is created, the servlet or JSP within the web app will save the state information about a client in what are called session attributes. And these attributes are saved by calling the setAttribute method, which is also part of the servlet API. The session object is then stored in a table or map of some kind within a designated storage area, and generally is going to be keyed by its unique ID. When the response goes back to the client, a cookie is set that will contain the unique ID, or if cookies are disabled in the browser, we may set the ID as a query string in the URL. Now, you've probably seen this done before on websites. It used to be done a lot, but it's not nearly as common as it used to be. So it's using one of these two methods that the session ID is saved on the client side, And strictly speaking, by the spec, cookie should be named JSession ID, but Webster actually lets you name that cookie, you know, if, or rename that cookie if you want to or need to. And usually this is necessary in more complex environments where multiple apps on different servers are working together and each needs to save its own session information so that they're not overriding each other's cookies. Okay, slide 7, please. So now the cookie is stored on the browser side with the unique ID for the client, and the session has been created and stored on the server side with the ID used as its key. That cookie will be sent in on each subsequent request made by that client. And then if the servlet or JSP that's handling the request needs to store new information about the client or retrieve old information, then it just calls get session again, and the container retrieves the session object using the ID and the cookie, and then that session is updated or read by the application using the get attribute or set attribute methods that, again, are both part of the servlet API. Okay, slide 8, please. The types of objects you can store in an HTTP session are really limited only by the size of the container holding the sessions. If you can turn some piece of data into a Java object, which you can do with virtually anything, then it can be stored in the session as an attribute. When the client logs off the application or the session sits inactive for some specific amount of time, then the session is invalidated on the server side, and the session object will be cleaned out of the table. At this point, if the browser sends in that JSession ID cookie again, with the new request, the container will just create a new session usually if the servlet or JSP calls get session. Okay, so that's a brief overview of HTTP sessions. That's really all you need to know for this presentation. Okay, let's move on to slide 9, please. So we'll talk about the different configuration options now available for our session management system, and we'll start off with the most basic one, in-memory session configuration. Slide 10. So we talked a little bit about how session objects are stored in the last section, and so they're generally stored in a map or a table of some kind. Well, with this configuration in Webster version 7, the session objects are stored in a Java map object directly in the JVM storage. So that's how it gets its name, in-memory. Since it's stored directly in the JVM storage, you can actually look at the table inside of a dump of the JVM heap using some of our tooling, like MDD4J. Slide 11, please. Okay, so here's a screenshot of a dump I worked on previously showing the actual session table and the sessions within it. As you can see, the table itself is of a type com.ibm.ws.session.store.memory.memorystore. And the sessions it holds are of type com.ibm.ws.session.store.memory.session.simple.hashmap. So basically the session table is a map of maps in our case, in our implementation. Each session itself is a map that can hold any kind of Java object bounded only by the JVM storage. Also, just a quick note, if you're looking at a dump and you see multiple memory store objects, because each application within an application server needs its own session table. Otherwise, you're going to get applications overriding each other's attributes in the same server. Okay, slide 12, please. So since the session table is actually stored in JVM, one of the most important things to look at when you're planning on using in-memory configuration is how large and how many session objects you'll need for your application environment. On the previous slide, I showed you a picture of a session table in a dump, and in that PMR that I was working on, the customer was actually having out-of-memory errors, and they were directly related to how large their session table had become. You can see in that screenshot that just one of the session objects had grown to 126 megabytes, which amounted to about one quarter of the entire JVM heap. So this is something that you want to be acutely aware of when you're planning for this configuration. And we see this a lot with JSF applications. So if you're using JSF apps or JSF in your applications, you want to really look at this in a test environment well. The JSF apps will store view information in session objects, and if that's left unchecked, they can grow very large. And this is actually, like I said, one of the more common causes that we see for out-of-memory errors when they're related to session growth. So our JSF implementation has properties that you can use to limit the number of views stored. So you'll definitely want to look into these if your applications are using JSF and you plan on using in-memory configuration. Okay, slide 13, please. One other thing to be aware of when you're planning on using this configuration is that the sessions, since they're stored directly in the JVM memory of a server region, that session will not be accessible by other server regions or other servers if you're in a cluster. So to resolve that problem, came up with this notion of session affinity. And session affinity is just a process we use that routes a request from a client that already has an existing session back to the server where the session was created. Slide 14, please. So we accomplish session affinity by appending a routing ID to the JSession ID cookie. So the JSession ID cookie may not just contain just the session ID. And that routing ID is used by WLM or the HTTP plugin if you're in a cluster configuration to make sure the request goes back to the originating servant. And you're probably wondering, though, what happens if the servant or server fails? Well, session affinity, it doesn't help here. The sessions that were in the servant are going to be totally lost. Once the region ends, the storage associated with that region is going to go away, obviously, and the state information that you were storing in those sessions is going to be lost. So while you can set failovers to route requests to different servers in the event of a failure, those requests won't have access to the associated sessions that were contained within the failing servant. Okay, slide 15. So the number one con for this configuration is obviously the lack of persistence if a servant or server fails. Another big con is the limited size of the session table. It's bound by the JVM memory. But the biggest pro for it is that it's easily the configuration with the fastest session retrieval and storage times. And obviously it's very simple to set up. It's just the default configuration. And these are really the major items you want to weigh in on when deciding whether or not to use in-memory configuration. Okay, let's move on to slide 16, please. So with the pros and cons in mind, in general, when would be a good time to use this configuration? Well, the biggest question is whether persistence of session data is critical to your app or not. If it is, then this configuration is obviously not going to suit your needs very well. If, however, performance is important to the application and the app does a lot of session manipulation, then this configuration may be the best for your environment. Okay, slide 17, please. So we talked about the least persistent configuration. Now we'll talk about the most persistent one, which is database persistence. Slide 18. So the basic idea with database session persistence is that we write the session data to a database table instead of storing it in memory where it's volatile. In theory, this should ensure that an application would never lose session data, but as we'll see, it's a little more complex than that depending on how you configure things. From an application standpoint, from the developer standpoint, nothing should appear different in your code, but under the covers, the container will update table in the database with a JDBC query when a session is altered. Okay, slide 19, please. So this is a screenshot of the database table description that I took directly from the Info Center. And you can see that each row contains the session ID and the app name. Remember, the different apps can't access sessions created in other apps, and a small, medium, and large row. The small, medium, and large rows are where the session data is actually stored. Since these rows are bounded by a row capacity, we have this notion of multi-row schema where basically each attribute in the session will get its own row. And this is basically going to make the amount of data you can store in each session bounded only by the database capacity. Okay, slide 20. Let's discuss a little more in depth on how the container actually gets and puts attributes into the session. At some point in time, the database has to be updated and a query has to be made using a JDBC connection. So as everybody's probably aware, this is a pretty expensive operation to make a connection to a database. So we try to cut down on the number of these if possible, and we use a session cache in memory of the most recently used and recently updated sessions. In addition, we have some tuning options available to allow some customization on the administrator's end, to how often or how much of the table is updated in the database. Slide 21. few of the major tuning options are on this slide. The right frequency is probably the most important of these, and this controls how often the container will actually do a database update. So the less frequent, the less intrusive these are, but also the less persistence you're going to have in the case of an outage. The right content tells us what to actually update on the table. You can either update all the attributes or just the ones that have changed. In most cases, obviously, you just update the ones that have changed. And the last one is the scheduled invalidation setting, and this controls when we'll go through the database and remove invalidated sessions. So you can schedule the invalidations to happen like once an hour or a few times a day, or you can schedule it once a day late at night when the traffic is low. This way you can customize the invalidation schedule so it makes as little impact as possible. Okay, slide 22. So the session cache is really a very important part of maintaining some decent level of performance with this configuration. And we'll use the cache whenever possible. And generally that's going to be for recently accessed sessions that have not changed. You can configure the session cache size by using the maximum in-memory session count setting, and that's found in the session management administrative panel for the server. The default for this setting is to hold 1,000 sessions. And when that size is reached, the older sessions will start being ejected from the cache. So once again, you'll have to be careful with this setting because the cache is actually in JVM storage. So the larger you make the cache, the larger the footprint's going to be on your JVM. One more quick note on this setting is that this is also the setting for the session table size for in-memory configuration. But usually the allow overflow flag is set to true, so that we don't bound the in-memory session table. It just gets bounded by the JVM memory. So the allow overflow flag, it doesn't have any effect if you're using distributed sessions, which, by the way, is just a term we use to refer to memory-to-memory or database persistence. Okay, slide 23, please. So what happens when a server ends and you're using database persistence configuration? Well, if a server in a cluster or servant in a multi-server region end, then obviously, at the very least, most of that region's session data should be stored in the database, and failover can occur. So another region in the configuration can service any clients that were previously being serviced by the failed server. So the WLM or the plug in it will route the requests that were previously going to the failed server to a server that's active. The trick is, how current is the session data in the database? Well, this all depends on your write frequency setting for the configuration. If you're writing in long intervals, you're likely going to have some dated session data in the event of a failure. If you're writing at the end of servlet, then you're very unlikely to have dated session data in the database, but the performance is going to suffer on that server. So when you're setting the write frequency, you have to weigh the benefit of high persistence versus the performance impact. Likewise, be aware that if you have a failure and your write frequency is not end of servlet, then you're likely going to have some percentage of users who experience an application problem on a failover. Slide 24, please. So if you're using database persistence and the session data is in a central repository where all the servants and servers in a cluster have access to the same session table, then it really depends on your write frequency settings as to whether or not you want to use session affinity routing. I would say that most customers I see with high availability configurations that are using some form of distributed sessions will generally still use session affinity routing and have a low write frequency, something around like 10 seconds. A 10-second write frequency should ensure that a good majority of your users will not experience session loss in the case of an outage. And however, if you do want to disable session affinity routing, obviously be sure to set the right frequency to end of servlet. Otherwise, you're going to see some session data loss for users and probably get some really odd application errors. Okay, slide 25, please. So the pros for this configuration are pretty obvious. It's the highest persistence session management configuration we have, and the session table size is virtually unlimited. And the session table is going to be obviously less of an impact on your JVM heap. It just depends on your cache size. Also, it provides that central repository for all the regions in a high availability environment. And the cons are equally obvious. It's expensive to make JDBC connections and to do queries, so your performance is going to suffer versus in-memory. In addition, it can be the most daunting to configure. It's probably going to require several teams to get everything set up, WebSphere admin, database admin, and probably security admin teams. Okay, slide 26, please. So on this slide, I just wanted to give you a very high-level overview of what's involved. It's, you know, I could make a whole presentation on the subject if we went into any depth. The basic steps involved are just to configure the JDBC provider and data source on the servers to make the connections to the database. And then you want to create and configure the database table, obviously, and configure the session management settings for each server. So, like I said, things are going to get much more involved in this, and so you'll have to involve several teams, most likely. And the detailed steps can be found in our Info Center at the link on the slide. So that page is a real good place to start, and it's going to link you to other important resources on the task. Okay, slide 27. So the most obvious reason to use this configuration is because your session data is critical and the preservation of that data is of extreme importance, even if it's at the cost of performance. On the support team, we'll often see customers who are using this configuration but just didn't consider the downside of the performance hit. So really planning for this configuration is very important, and you definitely need to consider that performance impact and weigh it against whether or not persistence of this level is really needed for the app. The development team they're always trying to improve the code in this area, but it's just a plain fact that making database connections is, and it's probably always will be, an expensive operation. So if you're on the bubble as to whether or not to use this configuration, it's important to do some testing and observe the performance differences in your environment. And just another good reason to consider the configuration is if your sessions or session table is very large and JVM space is an issue in your environment. Okay, slide 28. So this next configuration is sort of a balance between the two previous ones we talked about. It provides persistence, but not as high as database persistence, but it performs a lot better, but not as well as in-memory persistence, or in-memory sessions, rather. Still, it has some drawbacks, and we'll talk about those. Okay, slide 29. Memory-to-memory replication is just a process where we'll write sessions to replication instances in each of the servers participating in a replication domain. The basic idea here is that when a session gets updated by one of the servers that are participating, it gets propagated to the other replication instances so that each server will have a copy of the other server's sessions. There are two modes for this configuration, and when you're using peer-to-peer mode, which is the default, each server participating in the domain will act as both a client and a server, so that each server will both host a replication instance and replicate its data to other servers as a client. When you're using client-server mode, servers that are actually hosting the web app act as the clients and write their data to the servers that are hosting the replication domain. So those servers hosting the replication domain are just responsible for maintaining the session data, and the servers that are actually servicing clients, or they're just responsible for maintaining the session data for the servers that are actually servicing clients for the web applications. Okay, slide 30, please. So memory-to-memory replication relies heavily on our DRS data replication service. Each replication instance in a replication domain is actually a 2-gigabyte data space. But the 2 gigabytes are broken up into chunks to make the data storage and retrieval a little faster. But it also has the side effect of making the data space seem a little smaller, in that if one of those chunk spaces run out of storage, the DRS system will return that the data space is out of storage. So this limited size is actually something that's being looked at for improvement in the next release. Since we're moving into 64-bit servers, it's really something that we've got to improve on. But for the time being, in version 7, that limited size of the session table with this configuration is something that you'll definitely want to be acutely aware of when you're doing your planning. So as it was with database persistence, at some point the data in the replication instances have to be updated. But this operation is much less expensive in most circumstances. And also note that we do use the memory cache, the in-memory cache, the same way as we did with database persistence. Okay, slide 31, please. So when a region admins in this configuration, it works much the same way as it did for database persistence. Failover processing should send requests that were targeted for the failed region to a region that is up, and that region can use the session data inside its own replication instance to service the request. The more regions you have in the replication domain, the more backup you'll have in the case of a failover. But you also want to be careful because the higher number of servers, then the slower the replication becomes in a peer-to-peer configuration. So as each server will have to transmit data to all the other servers, you know, it's going to slow down a little bit. So you want to gauge carefully how large the server environment is for this reason. So yeah, just in general, the higher number of servers, the more performance is going to degrade with this configuration. Okay, slide 32. So just as with database persistence, you want to take care and set the appropriate write frequency for your environment. Again, a write frequency that's too long will result in some session loss on a failover, and a write frequency that is too short can degrade performance. And slide 33, please. Pros for this configuration are that you'll get better performance than database persistence and a somewhat equivalent persistence or equivalent level of persistence of session data. It's also going to be easier to configure. This can be done completely by the WebSphere admin in most cases, so you don't have to involve those other teams. The cons are that even though you do have a very good level of persistence, it's just not as rock solid as database persistence. There still exists the possibility that you'll lose all the servers in a domain, even if it's a minimal possibility, and that's going to cause a total loss of session data. And probably the biggest con right now is that the limited storage size and the configuration. In fact, if you're running a 64-bit server with a large JVM, it could be worse. Your capacity could be worse than if you're using in-memory storage. Okay, slide 34. So setting up this configuration can be generally done completely by the WebSphere administrator. Basic high-level steps are you want to decide what mode you want to run in, you know, peer-to-peer, client-server, and then create the replication domain and the replication instances for the servers involved, and then you want to set the tuning options. And again, I included a link with a more detailed explanation, and that's definitely a good starting point. Okay, slide 35. So a good general guideline for when you might want to use this configuration is when you're needing persistence, but you just can't absorb the performance impact that comes with database persistence. Also, as I said a couple times already, you'll need to gauge how large your session table will become, because this configuration can be wrong for you if you think you'll be running with a large number of sessions, or your session objects can become very large. And really, you only want to use this configuration in some type of high availability environment, using a cluster or at least a multi-servant server. It's really a pointless configuration if you're on a single app server with a single servant, because you'll basically just have one replication instance, and it's really not going to do you any good. Okay, slide 36. Just a summary, we talked about in-memory configuration, where the sessions are stored directly in the JVM memory. It has the limitation of no persistence, but it's easily the fastest performing of the three configurations. And then database persistence involves storing sessions in a database table. It has the highest persistence, but the largest impact on performance. And memory-to-memory replication was the last one we talked about, where servers are stored where servers store their sessions in a replication domain spanning a cluster or a multi-servant server. And it's got, like we said, good persistence, and it's a bit faster than database persistence, and the performance hit is not nearly as big. Okay, slide 37. This chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. visit the WebSphere Support's Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming WebSphere Support Technical Exchange webcasts like the one you attended today, and access previously recorded presentations. DeveloperWorks offers an in-depth technical information, and visit websphereusergroup.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get users up the learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online, and the My Notifications link on all support product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. So I'd like to thank you all for attending today, and I hope you guys found the information informative. And at this time, I'd like to turn it back over to Joseph, our moderator, who will open the line for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Chad, for a great presentation. At this point in time, Kathy, we would like to open the line for questions.
Our first question comes from Kevin.
Hi, can you hear me?
Hi, Kevin. Yep.
Hi, that was a good presentation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
My question was the max session count for non-distributed sessions, which is the 1,000 by default, is that for across all applications in that JVM or for each application?
Yeah, you can. I believe it's you can definitely set it for all applications in the JVM, but you can. I believe you can also set it for specific applications. For example, if you have one that you know isn't going to use, you know, 1,000 sessions at any one point, you could set that there. But yeah, you can definitely set it as a session management option across the server for all applications.
Okay, thanks. And one more question. Can you go over again that 2 gigabyte limit? Is that for each JVM?
Yeah, that's so the 2 gigabyte limit is really with, you know, that's memory to memory session replication, and that it's the limit that is the limit of the data space size when you're using memory to memory. So just remember, memory to memory session replication, that's where the sessions are actually stored in this data space. So it's not actually in the server region, in any of the regions for the application server. It's a sort of an external region that we use to store stuff in. So, and that's going to be, so if you have, let's say, 5 servers in a cluster or something like that spanning a couple of LPARs, that 2 gigabytes is going to be the size, you know, of the data space for each server. In other words, you can't have more than 2 gigabytes worth of session data across all those servers because each one's going to be replicating, you know, their data to the every other server's application instance. So it's definitely a limitation you got to take into account when you're thinking about using memory to memory. And hopefully in the next release, and if I'm hearing things correctly, you know, we're going to grow that data space so that limitation is no longer an issue.
So it's basically a bounded size for all the servants in the server.
That's correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Next question is from it's Walter Kaczynski.
Hi, Walter.
On the 2 gigabyte database or data space limit, has that changed since version 6.1? So that used to be stored in Java Heap, and now you've moved that to a data space?
Right. I believe in the last version we did store that either natively or in the JVM heap, and that's where things were replicated. I think we did it in the controller, I want to say, but I'm not totally positive on that. But yeah, I think this is a new thing in version 7, and I'm not sure that it was, you know, I'm not sure why we went with the 2 gigabyte limit, but it's definitely something that's being looked at very closely. I can tell
okay.
you that for sure.
Well, I was just curious. I opened a PMR because I didn't know, I guess to my surprise, yeah, the controller was going to, in first 6.1, which we're currently running, the controller was storing that information.
Right.
I thought that kind of surprising.
I mean, you still get, even if we're storing it in the controller, I mean, it's still going to be bounded by the region size right across all
the controller.
Servers,
sure.
Right.
Okay, and you mentioned that the write frequency tuning, you know, sometimes maybe a 10-second would be, you know, a good starting place to determine write frequency. Frequently, we have timeouts in our servant regions, and I'm wondering if we set the timeout delay before an EC3 occurs, will that write frequency hit so that data will be persisted, or does it just stop doing everything?
That's a good question. This is Walter, right?
Yep.
Yeah, let me get back to you, Walter. In fact, you might want to, if you don't mind, send me an email.
Okay.
And I'll, my email address is on the front page. of this presentation. So just toss me an email and I'll get back to you on that. I'm going to say yes, that's a good reason why you want to set that timeout delay so that we can finish up, you know, everything. So you could set like a 10 or 15 or 20 second timeout delay so that we could finish up the writes before the EC3. Because we do have control when an EC3 occurs, right? And
right.
We can bring it down, bring the server down gracefully.
Okay. And then you mentioned the session persist, or I guess this performance using database is greater. Has any testing been done with using like a type 2 connector if the instance is on the same LPAR?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure we're doing all kinds of testing, but I have to get back to you on that too. If you just want to send me an email, and I'll get back to you on those two and see what the differences are between the two types.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Walter.
Next question is from Bernie.
Hi, Bernie.
Hi, Chad. I had a question about the in-memory cache for the database persistence case. Is it going to cache just the attributes that are accessed by the application, or is it going to pull in the entire session from the database?
I'm not totally 100% sure on this, but I'm going to say that we will cache the entire session, right, so that it's used if the next request wants to access the session that hasn't changed, to avoid us having to go and, you know, get the attributes that are in the database, you know, for that aren't in the cache for some reason. But I will check on that, and I'll shoot you an email, Bernie.
Okay, thank you.
Next question is from Don.
Hi, Don.
Hi, Chad. How are you?
Good.
This applies to the memory-to-memory session replication, and you mentioned there were two different modes, the peer-to-peer and the client-server. Do you have to, in the case of the client-server, do you have to designate one of the servers in the cluster as the replicating server?
Oh, yeah. So basically, the way it's usually going to be set up is that you'll add a group of two or three servers that will host the replication domain, or host the replication instances, rather. And then, you know, you'll have two or three other servers that are actually, servicing clients through the web apps. And then those servers that are servicing clients will just write their session data to the servers hosting the replication domain.
So is that the only role that the host server has, is to keep the replication data?
Well, it doesn't have to be, but you know, yeah, usually it's a good idea. You don't want to experience timeouts on those servers or something like that where you lose, you know, those servers and you'll lose the session data that they're storing.
Oh, if that host server went down, you'd lose the replication data.
Right, exactly.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, our next question is from Babu.
Hi, Chad.
Hi.
Hey, we have WebSphere on ZOS, and we have multiple servants. We don't have a cluster or anything like that. Does the memory-to-memory configuration work for this?
Oh, sure, yeah. You can, yeah, the servants. In fact, I think there's a special setup that you can use where, you know, you can tell, you know, WebSphere to actually, you know, use the memory-to-memory for, you know, in the controller region for a multi-servant region. So that each of the servants has access to each other servant's, you know, session data. But certainly that's a pretty good case to use it, use memory to memory.
Okay, and one more question.
Sure.
Does this 2 gig limit, is this same for the 64-bit address space too?
Yeah, unfortunately it is. The data space that we use is not a 64-bit address space, unfortunately, in version 7. So yeah, it still comes into effect even in 64-bit servers. So that's what I was saying. You know, you could definitely see higher capacity if you're using in-memory than even memory-to-memory replication if you're using a 64-bit JVM with a large JVM heap.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Next question is from John.
Hi, John.
Hi, Chad. A very good presentation. Enjoyed it a lot.
Oh, thank you.
I have a couple of questions. In version 6.1, is the memory-to-memory dissimilar to the dynamic caching service? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, I think we used DRS in both versions. So it's the dynamic cache service. Yeah, I guess I'm not too familiar with exactly how that worked. That's actually worked on by a different team. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by if they're similar. Can you?
Yeah, can we use the dynamic cache on version 6.1 to do memory-to-memory replication?
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be something that WebSphere does, you know, that we would do for you. I guess if you wanted to cache your sessions there, then certainly I think with the dynamic cache service you could cache pretty much anything you wanted to. But it's not something that we'll do automatically, like if you update the session. You know, if you're using memory to memory, then we're going to use that replication instance, you know, to put session data in, even in version 6.1.
And second question, I may have missed it right at the beginning, I'm not quite sure, but why isn't Session Affinity just looking after this for us?
Well, Session Affinity is just, I mean, keep in mind, Session Affinity is just a process we use to route requests back to servants that originated the session. Right? I mean, so that's, it doesn't help you if the server goes down, you know, necessarily, because basically all Session Affinity does is if let's say you have a cluster with server A and server B, and you have a client that with a new request that comes to server A, and he, you know, creates a new session, or the app creates a new session, and then the ID gets associated with that client, you know, in the cookie. Well, we'll append this routing ID so that now when that client comes back in, he'll keep going to server A.
Right.
And so that's all Session Affinity does, right? Is it keeps sending it back to the same server that originated the session, right?
Same servant, right.
Right.
Yeah, because like we have an issue actually going on right now where we don't seem to have Session Affinity working for a particular application. I'm not quite sure why, but
yeah, we do have an APAR. It's a pretty big one, pretty big bug that came out in 7.09. But certainly, if you want to send me an email, I can send you that APAR. But it was a case where Session Affinity was failing in certain circumstances.
Because really, I think it should route it to the particular servant that we're actually application is talking to. So different users go to the different servants.
Yeah, and that's definitely a problem.
Okay.
So shoot me an email, and I'll give you that APAR number. I don't have it offhand.
Okay. Thanks very much, Chad.
Sure.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. There are no other questions at this time.
Thank you, Kathy. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.